Our next speaker is Gary Saul Morrison. Saul is the Lawrence Dumas Professor of Arts and Humanities and a Professor of Slavic Languages and Literatures at Northwestern University. I've asked Saul to talk about possible lessons from pre-revolutionary Russia. That's Revolution of 1917. Fire away, Saul.
Yeah, I've been asked about parallels with Russia for actually several decades. You may remember that when speech codes and the like started coming onto university campuses in the 90s, the New Republic did a whole issue directed to it. The New York Times reporter Richard Bernstein did a book called Dictatorship of Virtue, and it first came into the public consciousness with people asking how long would it be before this spread to the rest of society, and how long would it go? And I've been asked about this, for decades, and then about a week ago, the Wall Street Journal, Barton Swain there, asked to interview me about it. I don't know how strong the parallels are between Russia and before the revolution and ourselves today. There are quite a number of suggestive parallels, but I'm not an American expert, so I can't really go that far just to suggest what the parallels might be. Since the interview was published, my email box has been overwhelmed with responses, a number of them, from emigres from the Soviet Union, and several have said things like, at last there's an American who gets it. Of course, that doesn't mean they're right. It means their perspective is shaped by similar experiences to what academically I have studied. What they have in mind is a group that in the 19th century was called the intelligentsia. That's a word we get from Russian, where it was coined about 1860, but it did not mean, this is what's really important, educated people. It certainly did not mean open-minded people, intellectually curious people. To be a member of the intelligentsia, an intelligent, as it was called, you needed to basically have three characteristics, one of which was you had to identify primarily as that, so you could no longer be think of yourself as a nobleman. If you had a profession that had to be regarded as purely unimportant, and your primary identity had to be to the rest of the intelligentsia, and this is the second point, its way of thinking, it varied a bit, but it always included atheism, materialism, and a belief in socialism of some sort, perhaps anarchism, and revolution. This was your prime loyalty, and the characteristic thought was that you had to be absolutely and totally certain. That is, that there was no room for a middle ground, for compromise. You couldn't be an agnostic. You couldn't think, well, this is, maybe this is a good way to proceed, but maybe not. And part of the way in which you justified this was to claim that your views were based on science. The term social science was taken quite literally. As you probably know, Marxism thought of itself as a hard science. By the Soviet period, that meant if, Einstein's theories conflicted with Marxism-Leninism, then Einstein had to go. Same thing happened with genetics. This sort of thinking was rooted in the pre-revolutionary intelligentsia, where it was very odd because people who understood science thought that isn't the first characteristics of science open-mindedness, questioning? Doesn't it mean that some things in science are always changing and therefore you can't take it as a block? Some things are more certain than others. And you can't, above all, you can't get moral or political criteria out of science. Science just tells you what is, not what should be. But that was not the view of the Russian intelligentsia. One of their critics, a philosopher named Solovyov, famously paraphrased what he called the syllogism of the intelligentsia, which went, man is descended from the apes, therefore love your neighbor as yourself. And that was considered, a logical correlation. The point was that there could be no, it was always zero sum. Anything that didn't help us helped the enemy. No compromise was possible. And therefore, if you had an opportunity to destroy your opponent, you should push it as far as possible, or you were a traitor. Lenin made that an explicit philosophy. But by roughly 1900, there was a large group of people who didn't fit this. They were people who called themselves liberals. They didn't share the ideology. There was a large number of them. They weren't considered the classical intelligentsia, but they existed and they formed liberal parties. But they shared a similar mentality. Above all, their idea was you must never, ever criticize the revolutionaries. You were their allies, and no matter how far they went, you had to apologize for them. So the heads of the Constitutional Democratic Party, when asked if to condemn terrorism, now terrorism, in a sense, meant thousands of people, police officers, post office men, anyone who wore a government uniform was in danger of being murdered or having sulfuric acid thrown in their face. Bombs were being thrown in cafes. Thousands upon thousands more people were killed by terrorists and by police, incomparably more number. But when the liberals were asked, would you condemn terrorism, the famous quotation from the head of the party was, condemn terrorism? Why, that would be the moral death of the party. Well, people after the revolution would point out that it was the fact that there was no resistance, that in a revolutionary situation, as the war provided, no one would resist the Bolsheviks or anyone like them because they were morally incapable of doing so. They had signed on never, ever to resist. It was not possible earlier, and it certainly wasn't possible then. And that's the thing that the Russians have found so similar. Let me just give you just one quotation from Alexander Solzhenitsyn in his Gulag Archipelago, after he talks about how there was a workers' uprising in a Soviet city, and the Soviets moved in and basically executed or sent to Siberia everybody there, the whole town. And he writes like this: all you freedom-loving, quote, left-wing thinkers in the West, you left laborites, you progressive American, German, and French students, as far as you were concerned, none of this amounts to much. As far as you were concerned, this whole book of mine is a waste of effort, has nothing to do with you. You may suddenly understand it all someday, but only when you yourselves hear hands behind your back there and step ashore onto our Gulag Archipelago. This is sort of what Russians see as, you know, possible, and above all, they see it as the reason that people are morally afraid to say, yes, we agree so far, but we will not let it go any further. And that's what the Russians who are writing to me say. This is, you know, what is happening here. I'm not an American expert, I repeat, and I can't say how far. It certainly, I can say, is the case on university campuses where I live, and I can talk about that. I'm not an expert on the rest of society.
So I will come back to you in the Q&A. For those listeners who remember, Saul spoke a few weeks ago about a short story by Chekhov, so we've come a long way.